Hi, welcome to The Left Brain Artist. I'm Suzanne Redman. My interview today is with artist Craig McInnes. Craig has taken his talents into so many areas of his life. He's a fine artist, a musician, a muralist, a painting and drawing teacher, and the creative director of Fright Nights, which is a Halloween event here in West Palm Beach, Florida. Craig also worked to unite the artists in Palm Beach County through a think tank he formed, and later an organization called Art Synergy. He also helps to put on a large pop-up gallery called Continuum with artists and business owners Anthony and Trina Slade Burks. We talked at length about Continuum with Trina in her episode number 29, so give that a listen to learn more about that. Craig and I have been friends for a while, and he does a lot of name-dropping of local artists here in Palm Beach County. So, sorry for all the names you may not know, but realize that Craig has expanded his art business by the collaborations he's done with so many successful artists. And come on back to my podcast, because I just may get to some of those names in future interviews. So enjoy our conversation, and hopefully this will help you find some ways you can expand your art career as Craig has. This is Craig McInnes. Craig, thanks for joining me today.
Oh, thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
Yeah. I'm excited to talk to you because you are probably the most art-filled person I know. You have branched out into so many areas of the art world, and I'm dying to let everybody hear about it. But let's start with the beginning. I know you have a family background of art because you post pictures that your mother does on Facebook. She's an amazing artist. So tell me about how you got started in art in your family.
She would always draw. That was her kind of hobby, unwind. And I was a little kid and I'm asking her, draw this toy and draw that cartoon character. And she would kind of do, you know, she would just go through the motions, draw me a Spider-Man, draw me a hot rod car or whatever. And that's what got me started. And the kid drawings, you know, when I look back at my five-year-old drawings, they're like any five-year-old, you know, the car doesn't have any wheel wells and everything. The trees are lollipops and all that. But it clicked. It started to click the more that I would draw alongside of her and all that. And then as I realized that it was running through my blood, and I got the cognitive ability to understand that, oh, I could really foster this. That's when it really started to kick in around fifth, sixth grade. And then I met some other kids who drew and, you know, we became fast friends. And so it just kind of blossomed, I guess, as my brain started to develop and realize.
Okay. All right. Where was it that you grew up?
Connecticut.
Connecticut. Okay. So in your middle school and high school age, did they have an art program? Were you taking art classes?
Yeah, actually, my high school and still is one of the highest rated schools in America. It's really tough. I didn't do so great academically, but the art and the music was killer there. So I took full advantage of that. And like I said, I had a few of my peers that I viewed as mentors because they were further along on their journey than me. And I kind of chased them around through school.
Okay. And what about
art anyway?
Yeah, right. And what about That's teachers? Cool. Did you have any teachers that really knocked it out of the ballpark for you in class?
No.
No?
Music. Yeah. Music I did. But in art, not so much. It was more this one good friend, and I'll even name him Aaron. And he's still an artist, of course, to this day. He lives on the West Coast, San Francisco. And he was drawing like way ahead of our level, way ahead of like seventh grade level. And I was just, my eyes were bugging out of my head. So I kind of like stole from him and like borrowed from him and made sure to sit down with him after school and we hung out and all that stuff. And so, yeah, he became like a peer mentor and it was awesome.
Oh, that's great. And was the music about equal amount of time you were spending on music and art at that time?
You'll love this. So somewhere around fifth grade when all of our voices changed, fifth, sixth grade.
Oh, right. Yeah.
My music stopped dead because I was like, nope, we're done here. Because I had no, I lost my elementary school music teacher who brought me like from ground zero to learning how to perform and sing and all that stuff.
Okay.
And when I got into middle school, she wasn't there to like kind of help me through that tumultuous, what the heck is going on with this thing? My range just changed. And So I just bailed on it until I got back, until I got to Florida, and then it started back up again.
Okay. All right. So we'll talk about the music a little bit later. So, was the art school that you went to after high school the reason you went to Florida? That's why you came down here?
Yes, totally.
And was it right after high school?
The summer off, like most would, but then I slammed right in the fall. I was in Fort Lauderdale while I was in West Palm, commuting to Fort Lauderdale to do Art Institute.
Okay, that's great.
My mom had a friend down here. She came down. She was looking for a change as well. And I followed her down. I basically, instead of living on campus, I lived with her and I did the commute back and forth, which made it pretty seamless.
Oh, yeah.
Logistically awful, but monetarily smart.
Right. I gotcha. Yeah. Because everyone thinks West Palm and Fort Lauderdale are so close, but it's a hike. Yeah. Yeah. So did you have a major that you chose when you went to the Art Institute of Fort Lauderdale?
Yes. At that time, it was a little more narrow than it is now. Well, they're closing now, but I mean, Art Institute in general has a lot of options these days. We're talking 1991. Excuse me. So it was advertising design.
Okay.
I was fully convinced that I wanted to work at ad agencies as an idea person.
Uh-huh.
The first drawings and all that stuff. That was where my strength was, and I still have that, being able to kind of like jot someone's idea down real quickly in a drawing that everyone can kind of nod on or nod against. So that I was convinced was going to be it. And, you know, an 18-year-old is convinced of everything that they ever thought in their little mind. So it was a good jump off point because Art Institute is wide and varied. They had us shooting photographs and editing video and painting and drawing. And so it was well rounded regardless of what the moniker was for the actual degree.
Oh, I gotcha. Okay. All right. So what did you do right after Art Institute? Did you go right into a job? Did you say, hey, I want to go to an advertising agency?
Yeah. And in fact, I interned as one should.
Yeah.
But nothing legit. Like there's a job placement program, and I'm using the quotation marks.
Yeah.
The job placement program for Art Institute was dodgy at best. So I ended up in some situations that were not optimal, not dangerous or anything. Just like, I'm not learning anything. I'm all like one step, you know, from taking out the trash and cleaning the toilets in this place. So again,
okay,
that was probably,
well, you know, we all have to start somewhere.
I'm like, that's a janitor.
Yeah.
But it was also a young man's pride too. I was like, what am I going to do? The advertising stuff, you know? And so that was a short tenure, and then I did whatever every goofball kid does. I did something completely different. I joined a band.
Okay.
And I started doing the music because I met some people. I was working at a record store to keep me going through school to pay the bills. With a little side of – I ended up doing faux finishing is the short answer.
Oh, okay.
After school, it was a faux finishing company that kind of at least it was something creative kind of thing. Kept me from working at a – who knows what, a Blockbuster or something.
Right.
So, went from the record store to doing music to doing the faux finish. That was the transition out of school.
Okay. And that was residential or commercial? Both?
Both.
Okay.
Both. Yeah.
All right.
It was good.
Yeah.
It was good. At the time it was a very low paying and strenuous job up and down, you know, 30-foot scaffolds and all that crazy stuff. Cause it was big houses and big, you know, big restaurants.
Okay.
But in retrospect, it was so influential on what is happening for me now.
Oh yeah. Yeah. I mean, gosh, just the skills for doing murals, which you've been doing too. Yeah.
Yeah. So it was a good jump. I got lucky.
Yeah. Okay. Really. All right. And where did you go from there?
So from the faux finishing stuff. So it was just a job for me. So the music was what I was concentrating on because you know, there was this brotherhood kind of thing going on, you know, and again, to talk about the youth, a 19, 20 year old man or boy, if you want to say, is in need of that camaraderie and all that. So the music thing just took right off.
Great.
And, it was awful at first. It was kind of like you talking about editing your first podcast versus editing your 33rd podcast. My first band was just like, it sounded like pots and pans getting thrown down a stairwell. So in comparison to what I do now. But it was wonderful, and over the course of a few years, there was member changes and all kinds of stuff, and I ended up in a very solid band that got management and toured and tried to get a record deal during that, that beautiful time in the 90s when there was, a lot of record labels.
Oh, yeah.
Everything was, there was a lot of music festivals, traveling festivals.
Yep.
And it was hard rock and heavy metal. That stuff was all hot then.
Yep.
So I abandoned my art other than in the context of the band. I would do band artwork and t-shirts and stuff.
Oh, okay. All right.
No clients. I didn't have any clients. I wasn't doing paintings per se once in a while, maybe.
Yep.
So yeah, my mother never said anything because she's really cool about what I want to do, but she was probably like, you just got a degree. Why are you over here now, left field, man? Or maybe she didn't think that. Maybe she's like, we'll figure it out.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, early 20s, my gosh, everybody needs to give it a try, whatever it is. Yeah.
No regrets at all.
Yeah,
I mean,
good.
Chasing a record deal is like one of those really crazy out there dreams,
yeah.
Even now.
Yeah.
And if we didn't do it, we'd probably, the five of us, the band members would probably be like, why didn't we just push it a little harder? And we did. We pushed it all the way. So.
Okay. Did you get a record deal?
Nope.
But you pushed
turned
it hard.
Turned down by the best of them. Turned down by Atlantic. Turned down by Geffen. Turned down by Warner Brothers.
But you were dreaming big, so that's good.
And we've sat in all the offices, and they were all pretty much, I'm sure when we walked out, they slid our CD into the trash can. It was fine, though. It was absolutely fine.
Okay.
You know, we were too stubborn to play ball anyway. And they're like, what if you do this and what if you that? And we're like, no.
We're artists. We need to make our own decisions.
Pretty much. Our stubbornness is probably what kept us from a deal, which is also fine.
Yeah.
Also fine.
Yeah. And so where did you go when your group made the decision, okay, let's stop this? Or did you make that decision or just kind of –
It splintered. It did what most groups do. We recorded an amazing CD, an 8-song CD, which was like the quintessential sound. It was the best the band had ever been.
Yeah.
But personally, we were falling apart.
Okay.
The business, it sounds like a behind the music, and that's how you know that these things are really, that's how it goes.
Yeah.
We didn't hate each other. Just the camaraderie had been, watered down over time.
Okay.
The business had gotten in the way. Disagreements, mostly about business. Musically, like I said, we were still firing on all pistons, but recorded an amazing album, put it out maybe for a couple months. It did okay, and then we broke up.
Okay. All right. What was the name of that group?
Gone Mad.
Gone Mad. Okay. Okay.
Yep.
So where did you go from there?
I chased my tail. I was like lost. What do I do? I think I did stumble myself back into the faux finishing because it was, it was there for me on and off during the music thing.
Yep.
Also worked for, oddly enough, I worked for Sherwin Williams. I was like, assistant manager at one of their bigger stores for a while because there was flexibility there as well. My boss was really cool.
He let me
be the musician. So I kind of stumbled right back into the whole paint thing. But with an edge of, trying to push the mural thing. Instead of just doing washes and glazes and wood and all the faux stuff.
Yeah. But at this point, there wasn't the mural scene downtown in different cities like there is now.
You're talking maybe Amanda had her Howley's mural, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And Sammy had some stuff in Lake Worth. And
okay. So there were a couple.
I think Eddie was just about to pop off with that big wall on Respectables, and so that was going to crack the door.
Okay.
But yeah, no, it was I did a couple restaurants. Like my first one was in a now defunct restaurant. I did a bagel shop. I did some like New York-esque Times Square looking stuff. So some of my first ones were ambitious, but artistically crude looking back. Like I really struggled. I really underpriced them.
Oh, yeah.
The typical, young artist coming out, not undervaluing and things like that. But
yeah, you got to start somewhere. Was it you approaching them or them approaching you? How did you get these jobs?
I hustled them because I wasn't I'm in case people don't know, if you ever met me, I'm obviously extroverted. I have I have kind of a big mouth and too many opinions. So I just went, I'm going to cold call the Yellow Pages because this is the internet's not even really that juicy at this point, what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
We're still Yellow Page days.
Yeah.
And pictures and stuff. So I'm cold calling anything that's under design or art or interior design or anything like that, event companies, all that stuff. I'm just cold calling them and visiting people and showing them my thin little portfolio.
Yeah.
There's school stuff, right? And then there's this gap of gap of time where I did music, and then there's like two new murals in there, and I'm like, you know, I'm just trying to shake all the bushes, which is still what I do.
Well, I mean, and that was a great way to get back into it after being away for a while and realizing, okay, I got to make money, and it's not all going to be Sherwin-Williams money.
And do you know, and I was burnt on that whole corporation thing. That's just not my, it's not my thing.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Do you know the artist Teresa Korber?
No, no. Who is she?
You may want to look her up. She's a stalwart for this scene as well, because I will credit her with getting me back into fine art. She was doing these shows at the Lounge. The Lounge was a little like nightclub dance club that is where Hullabaloo is now.
Okay. Right in downtown West Palm.
Yeah. It was in that exact space. And she started throwing these themed art shows, and it was like, you know, for February it would be love is a risk or love and hate or whatever. And they would always be themed to that time of the year. And I think they were monthly even, or maybe bi-monthly.
Okay.
And so you were forced into a theme, and you were going to come with all your stuff, and you were going to set up a little booth, and the place was just packed with artists. And I actually met some of the people that I know now from the scene there, because there really was no, you didn't have your link from underground to fine art like you do now. Like, there's a little more of a ramp these days. Then it was very much segregated, and I felt there was no art scene at all. So when Teresa came along with this show, it just got me painting again and thinking, and I treated it as a client. You know, she's like, okay, the theme is this. And I'm like, ooh, I'm forced into this pigeonhole.
And you have a deadline. Yeah.
And I have to produce by the next day.
Yeah.
So it was totally awesome. It got my paintings kicking again.
Oh, that's great.
So I credit her with that completely. And she's great people, and to take that on, because it was a huge task. Imagine, you know, it's like similar to like doing a continuum where you have to get all these artists on time and doing their stuff. And
yep. Yeah.
So she absolutely killed it. And that led to, more murals and more exposure for myself and everyone else who's involved in those shows.
Oh, that's wonderful. How long did she do this?
If you ask her, she'd probably say too long, because it really got big and out of control. It moved to Respectables because it got so big. And,
okay.
If I had to guess, my perception is that it was at least a couple years.
Oh, wow. Wow. Yeah. I think that was before my time. Yeah.
I think I was going to say I did quite a few paintings for it, and most of them sold. So it really did so much for me, because it made me produce, and then it got them, it got exposure, and it got those paintings out the door.
That's great. Yeah. You weren't just producing to create an inventory, because you were selling too. Yeah. That's wonderful. And so what happened after that? So you were doing a lot of murals. You're getting your name around, but kind of in the indie scene.
Yeah. Let's see. What would be the quintessential point when funny enough, I went through a drought where – I don't know if it was based on self-doubt or if the scene dried up, or like Teresa's thing went away and I didn't know what to do. My art didn't fit in the fine art world of South Florida the way it existed then, or perhaps even now, depending on who you talk to, because I'm definitely not painting seascapes or bowls of fruit or conch shells. So
right.
I my influences too, my Dali influences, my Tim Burton, so I think I went through this dry period, and therefore I didn't have work, and therefore didn't have money. I had to go back to getting the real job.
Okay.
And I saw something in the paper that Jerry's Artorama was looking for a manager, store manager.
Okay.
And I'll chuck this in there. I was doing Fright Nights. Fright Nights was going on since 2003. I was doing Halloween stuff since 2003.
Okay.
So that was in conjunction with Flow Finishing and all that kind of stuff.
Okay. All right. We'll talk about Fright Nights a little bit later, because there's so much to talk about with that. But so go on. So you started working at Jerry's. Okay.
Yeah. And they interviewed me for the store manager, but I was too stubborn still. I guess this is an underlying theme to my life. Stubbornness.
I'm thinking, yeah. And yet, somehow you're successful.
Just ask my wife. I won't compromise on my career, but when it comes to like where my career is going to go, I'm like, nope, I don't like that. And I can't see myself doing it. So I'm just going to, facepalm it. But, so I told Jerry's I didn't want the store manager position.
Okay.
Because of Fright Nights mostly. I was like, I have to be gone. Like, I have to commit time to it. I think I was a house designer at the time, or I might have already been creative director. So that forced me into talking to him about options. And he came up with this outreach director, position. And then he hired someone else to be the manager. And so I would work in conjunction with, and I would go out and talk to art entities, galleries, festivals, places that show and teach art, and try to drum up business for Jerry's to sell the material to these places. So that outreach director position, in retrospect, at the time I was like, it's a job. But as I started to network, I was like, I kind of felt like, oh shoot, this is weird. I'm like helping my career while I'm trying to sell, and I'm helping them too. Cause I'm like, okay, I'm going to offer you whatever deals Jerry's has. Like if you buy X amount of this, you're going to get a discount on that. So it was just a beautiful cyclical thing that was occurring.
Yeah, it was kind of a win-win because you were getting to know so many artists all over the county in that position. That's where we met when you came to the Wellington Art Society.
Yep, and the
players. And I met you when you did a presentation. Yeah.
All the players, the curators, the people who were hustling it, doing what I didn't realize I wanted to do, but that were doing what I wanted to do. And it lasted, I think I was at Jerry's for a couple seasons, and then it changed
management. Okay.
And I had to bail.
Yep.
And that's a whole story, but an irrelevant one. And that's how I met Trina, and that's how I met you, and Trina says it all the time. When I met Trina at Jerry's, she said that I had told her, we're going to work together. I don't know how we're going to work together, but we are definitely going to work together. And, of course, that came true. So Trina's just a huge example of what happened during that time of networking. And that was as simple as her coming in the store. I wasn't even out and about when I met her. It's how I met Rolando. It's how I met a lot of people because he had Boynton Beach Art District even then.
Right.
And so I paid that a visit. And I'm like, I want to meet all your artists. I want to sell them art supplies. I want to, you know. So I was hustling it for Jerry's, but it was also opening up my mind to realize that, hey, look at all these avenues that I could go down artistically and business-wise.
Okay, yeah. Okay. All right. So I actually interviewed Trina a couple episodes ago. We're talking about Trina Slade Burks, who owns ATB Fine Artists with her husband. We're doing a lot of name dropping in this episode, but you've partnered with Trina on some really big art projects. So why don't you tell me about some of those projects that you've done in the West Palm Beach area in Florida?
The time that I met Trina at Jerry's was important because I was starting to get a feel from everyone going to these meetings and just chatting with people in parking lots and stuff that there was this undercurrent of dissatisfaction of how the scene was too splintered and everyone's competing with each other and it's very cutthroat and da da da. And so I started hypothesizing like maybe we should put some kind of think tank together. And it was literally just called the think tank. And I think I ended up asking Rolando if we could do it at Boynton Beach Art District and picking his brain to figure out, you know, who should come to this. Because I know some people, but he knows probably even more. And that's probably still true. And we filled up a room with people. And the think tanks went on a handful of times. And it got whittled down to all the doers, let's say. By me having a staunch policy of if you're going to complain, have a solution. In fact, skip the complaint and let's jump to the solution or this is going to be a 10-hour meeting. And we all know that our complaints are all the same, right? They all echo each other. They're all very similar vein. So let's start figuring out how we can start chopping these things down. And one of the first things that came out of it was the thought that individual artists, entities, everyone should try and find a way to glom onto these art fairs, Art Palm Beach being the first one we're talking about, and another name drop, but the Hennevelts had a connection with Art Palm Beach. Hennevelts are local artists and curators. And we thought, man, what if we do some local shows attached to Art Palm Beach? Maybe they'll help us promote it. Maybe they'll – we didn't know. We were just thinking, look, Art Basel came to town in Miami. And every single coffee shop, every single brick and mortar is like, it's Art Basel. Yay. And everyone was hanging work and everyone was doing live this and da da da. And we're like, and here's West Palm, like, you know, sitting with its arms crossed, you know, like not taking advantage of this beautiful, similar kind of situation. So that's where this whole art synergy concept came from. Now, circle back to the Trina thing. We wanted to take each, the theory was that we would take each town or city and they would host a show. West Palm Beach, Lake Worth, Delray, Jupiter, whoever wanted to play ball. And when it came to West Palm, my natural thought was that Trina and Anthony would be a great fit to to make a show happen, because they were already doing Boys to Men. They were already doing these collaboration shows. They were doing pop-ups like crazy and having success.
Yeah.
And I'm like, let's just make a new brand. And I kind of, I feel like I nudged them hard into it too. I wasn't like, hey, what if? I was kind of like, and you guys will be my West Palm people. And
yeah, because we know you'll do it.
Yeah, because I know you'll kick ass. And the first year, Continuum really did kick ass. So the three of us partnered up and created it with the Downtown Development Authority, because they were looking for opportunities like this. They were leading into this thought process of having an arts district. And a big pop-up gallery would be a great, you know, first thing to be have on that checklist. So they provided us a beautiful spot right on Clematis, and the three of us put out an art call, and now it's 5 years in. It's been all over the place. It's been on Fern. It's been at City Place. It's been at Clematis three times, I think, maybe two times.
Yeah, City Place twice.
City Place twice. So yeah. we're our fifth year in. Yeah. So now it's like a staple. It's a staple thing.
Yeah. People look forward to it every year.
And there's still a beautiful synergy, so to speak, between us and Art Palm Beach. And we're looking forward to working. There's another art fair in town as well that we're looking forward to hopefully working with. The art synergy thing still goes on. I'm not part of it anymore, but I'm just concentrating on Continuum. But that whole section around Art Palm Beach, that whole time slice is now like an art week thing. And I think more and more people are glomming onto it. AJ has always been a player up in Lake Park, the Lake Park yep. district. They have a nice little thing going on there during that same time frame. So I think what we started long ago, we were very idealistic, like it was just going to like catch fire and just be amazing right out of the bat. But here we are 5 years later, and now it's starting to really look like something. It's starting to take a shape. And again,
and it's got. Yeah, it's got a reputation, Continuum, the pop-up gallery, and people look forward to it because Art Palm Beach is always the last week or weekend and long weekend in January, and that's when Continuum is, so that they can hopefully get the same people come over from Art Palm Beach over to their pop-up gallery, wherever it is downtown. Yep. And so people are counting on it because they know it's there, and the whole concept that you guys created with Continuum is that – we're not just going to open up a pop-up gallery, but we're going to have events around it for an entire three-week period to get people to come in. Yeah. And some of the events might be, you know, loud and crazy, live band, everybody dresses up, or it might be kind of quiet, let's do a brunch. Yeah. It's become a great concept. Yeah.
Yeah, I urge everyone to check out Continuum. And it's hard to describe because it is a multidisciplinary kind of thing. There's a lecture, there's video, there's body painting, there's music, like you mentioned, there's fashion. So we don't, it's not just visual art. We, kind of try to spread it over all of it, over all the possible creative fields that we could fit into a space. And then again, the tie-in with Art Palm Beach, I'll take this opportunity to thank the Lesters for being so, forthcoming with their support all this time of synergy in general and Continuum. As well, because to have the opportunity to promote something that is a local or regional flavor like Continuum, but have it promoted through something international like Art Palm Beach and allow that opportunity to occur, that door to open of someone who is in town just for Art Palm Beach because they want to see this new, amazing, cutting edge contemporary art. But then they catch wind of or hear or see a piece of marketing for Continuum and they're like, oh, that's just across the street. And do right across the street, and perhaps they will pop in our gallery and be a collector of ours. And that is just a beautiful possibility. I'm quite sure it has occurred on numerous occasions at this point, and it will only grow from now. So,
yeah. And definitely do a shout. I'll do a shout out to Leanne Lester, because one of the things that they offered at Art Palm Beach, which is a very large contemporary art fair at the convention center in West Palm Beach, is they offered a booth to Art Synergy.
Yeah.
And I mean, that was huge that you had a booth and you were able to fill it with local art and then able to have the print materials for Continuum and some of the other things that were happening at the same time. Yep. So yeah, that was great.
And to this day, Rolando and Eileen are still heavily partnered. And I believe, I mean, I know they had a booth last year, but I'm quite sure they will have a booth this year. And so the initiative continues, and anything that Synergy does is going to benefit local art as well. the original concept has been changed and moved, and I don't know what the trajectory is now, but it's always in a positive direction, because local art on international stage via Synergy or Continuum or whomever is just, you can't beat it.
Right. Yeah. It's amazing. And like you said, it was grand plans, but it's not going to be huge overnight, but it's been 5 years and it's been pretty good. Yep. Yeah. And people look forward to it. The artists look forward to that call to artists, which, by the way, will be coming out shortly. So indeed. I'll put links to all these things on the show notes for the webs for the podcast.
Cool.
All right. So that's a pretty huge project that you working on Art Synergy and then also Continuum. And for a few years, you did them both at the same time.
Oof, that's how I ended up not doing Synergy anymore. I was like, I'm doing both at 50%. Sorry, both of you. But I had to leave one.
Yeah. So that's the events the end of January, but it really starts in the fall. But in the fall, you're huge with Fright Night. So let's talk about that now. Start out by just telling it what it is and where it's located.
Fright Nights is at the South Florida Fairgrounds. It is a haunted house event. It also has a midway. It has, games, food, entertainment. That morphs from year to year. Sometimes it's a giant midway. Sometimes it's medium. Sometimes there's more entertainment. Sometimes there's less, but it's always a fun time. It's all Halloween based. And it's kind of hard to describe as well. Again, you need to visit our social media. You need to visit our website because it changes so much. It's really hard to describe, but generally I'll tell you this year is, we have 400 houses, indoor haunted house walkthroughs. We have carnival rides. And like I said, we have a dance troupe that comes out there that's like themed, and they do all this crazy stuff with props and flames and smoke and,
oh, that's cool.
We'll have some live bands. We always have, our DJ from Continuum, of course, Cole, comes out there and provides our music. We have walkthrough scare zones. So when you're out on the midway, you're not necessarily not getting scared. There's a lot of stuff out there that can shock you at any moment.
There's the fully made up costumed cast walking around scaring the daylights out of everybody. I've been to your Fright Nights, and those are some really scary, oh my gosh, really scary haunted houses. I went with five little 12-year-old girls, and they had a death grip on the back of my shirt. I had to be the engine going through it first as they held on to me like a train. But you started. Your role in it started very small, and then over the years you became creative director, which is a huge role in that whole process. So tell me how you first started and how you got to where you are today and what you do.
Well, this is my favorite story to tell students. Like when I get illustration students or cartooning students or even just my drawing students, if I ask them, are you going to do a creative career? And they say yes, then I make sure I give them at least the abridged version of this of, look, kids, it sounds cliche, but this is literally the story. You can do anything you want to do. You just got to look for the doors, and you got to shove your foot into the doors. And that's literally what I did. So it started, like you said, quite humbly. I was acting in a haunted house that was down on Clematis. The two haunt designers from there were hired by Fright Nights. I followed them out there. I was just going to be a scare actor. And then they're like, okay. they knew I was a visual artist. They're like, hey, can you do a crazy face or a this or a that? Can you make that look like brick? Can you make that look like rust? And the answer, of course, was yes, because I had full finishing background.
Right.
So it led me into designing a few little logo type things or a mural of like a skull or whatever they needed to juice the house up. And, so that got me doing set design technically, because now I've gone from people's living rooms into this haunted house industry, which is a lot more up my alley, right? Because it's like all weird stuff, all ugly stuff. It's a lot easier to do than pretty. that just blossomed. I kept making my worth known by just like doing the work ethic thing, show up on time, deliver more than is expected, come up with fresh ideas for them that, like they may not have thought of and whatever, just what I love to do anyway. And that led to their boss looking at me and saying, do you want to do your own haunted house? So we had, we had 300 houses and they were going to divvy one off for me. And, so 05, I got my hands on one of the houses and, it was design wise, it was very simple. I took it really easy on myself. I was like, I'm just going to make it visually cool, but it's not going to be super detailed. And, looking back on it, it was cool and effective, but it was a little bit lame, but it's like anytime you're doing something big for the first time, it's like my mind was blowing. I'm like, I got 22 rooms to design. I got to figure out the lighting, the props, the sound that I didn't know what to do, man. I'd never done something at this scale. So,
That's huge. Yeah.
05 was a mess. It was a mess, but it was good. It went, it took off. It was fine, you know, because as I still say, you can design something beautiful, but if you fill it with bad actors, it's not good anyway. So my house was moderately okay looking, and I filled it with maniacs, and it was scary. So it was a success. It was a success.
Yeah, so the people made it awesome.
And they still do to this day. Our sets are great now. You could film a movie in some of these things. But if you put a dud in there for an actor, it's pointless. I mean, you know, what is it, a photo shoot or is it a haunted house? It's supposed to be about the scares. So back then.
So for example, how many people will you have in one haunted house?
25.
If it's 25. Okay.
Maybe 30 if we pepper it with volunteers. And that's a lot because the thing is, 40 by 50 by 150, something like that. It's not gigantic. You know, it's like 6,000 square feet or something like that. So it happens fast. Over the course of 22 rooms, you're going to encounter 30 characters. It's detailed. If you remember, I don't know. You might've had your eyes.
Yeah. No, I had to keep my wits about me since I had to take care.
You went with the perfect group. 12. You went with the perfect group.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. And they, oh my gosh. It was so much fun. Well, I had one girl that bailed right at the entrance. We waited in the line and it was kind of a long line that night. We get all the way to the front and she suddenly starts crying and runs out of the line. Meanwhile, she's my responsibility. And I said, wait, where are you going? We can't all. And I had five other girls who still wanted to do it. And she ran away. And so one of your people was not, I said, the other mom is waiting out on the bleachers. And one of your people was nice enough to walk her over to the other mom. Sure. I could see the mom and point. And I said, she just needs to be over there. And so,
This scenario occurs a lot. The fire marshal calls them emergency doors. I call them chicken doors. They're all throughout the house and they say in a big black light lit thing, exit. But I want to put chicken door on it because it's like, you paid the money, man. Just go in and get your adrenaline going. Don't bail now. But, it happens. So the one house, my second year doing the house, I met my good friend and cohort now, Alex Rodriguez, who's my operations manager out there.
Okay.
He co-designed it with me. And, he just proved himself to be such a organizational beast. And like we were yin and yang. Like I had the creativity, just flames just shooting out of my eyeballs with ideas. But logistically, I was like a spaz and he wasn't. He was like very methodical. So we just became, we became a monster of not only building and decorating and casting a house, but then running it. So like it ran like a well-oiled machine. All of our paperwork was in on time. Our actors were where they needed to be when they needed to be. They were well behaved when they weren't, in the house. So.
Oh, that's huge. Yeah.
Again, our boss was looking at us like, what do you got going on over here? Cause some of the other houses might be running more like, trying to catch lemmings. It was just like, where's the actors? Where's this? Where's the makeup? And ours was very much, it was probably too strict, honestly. You know, it probably wasn't as fun as the other houses because we were kind of like, sit in your seat and stay in your seat so I know where you are. You know, and you're talking to like 17 to 20-year-old, they don't want to be taught like that, told like that. They just got out of school, you know what I mean? So, but it works. So,
and they want to make their own agenda and just run around crazy. Yeah.
But it's just too many when you have, 25 people to put in makeup and wardrobe. So basically our boss looked at that and said, would you guys manage the entire deal, the houses, the rest of the house, and kind of implement whatever this program is you got going on that seems to be working. And once that happened, that's pretty much what became the blossoming of Alex becoming always operations and me becoming creative director, which is I hesitate to take this there is no other thing to call what I do, but creative director is just, it has this, I don't know, it has a stigma to it that I have control
over. Oh, really?
Over all the, in my mind, maybe, that I have control over all of the creative stuff. When actually what it boils down to is there's a creative team and all I'm there is to help them facilitate what they have. Alex and I, co-creative direct because they bring us all their raw ideas and we sit at a table and we whittle it down. Cause again, Alex being a logistical master, he can say, that's a great idea, but there's no way to do it in real world. You can't do it because, you know, these are the restrictions of how we build or how big that is or whatever it is.
Okay.
So it, yeah. It's a team of, at this point, there's about 12 people, 12, 15 people from makeup to wardrobe to haunt designers to everything that are under our umbrella, so to speak. And we just help them facilitate their ideas. So there's no real directing. I don't sit in a chair with a beret on and like, you know, point with my laser pen, like, no, move that over there. You get up on that ladder, dance monkey.
Yeah.
It's very much a lot more low key and collaborative effort than anyone might imagine. But,
okay.
But I'm still blessed.
How many weekends is it open?
We've done this year. It's 3 weekends, 9 nights.
Nine nights. Okay. So give me a feel for, when do you start on this? I mean, I'm sure you start, you know, with the 1st of November right after it, thinking about next year, but when do you start on it in the fall? And when would you say it's really hot and heavy? I mean, you're really eat, drink, sleeping, fright nights. So right now it's middle of August.
Right now, Alex and team have built 3 out of the 4 haunted houses already.
So they're designed completely then.
The design occurs before March, like on paper.
Okay. All right.
And that's on the haunt designers. And then they run it up the pike and Alex and I look at it. Alex usually breaks it down and makes them piece it back together because it could always be better. Right. And, that's March. And then we kind of just have a few meetings leading into the summer. Then the street team starts to go out and do concerts to promote our casting call somewhere in July.
Okay.
And like I said, in August, second week of August, Alex starts building. Then in September is when it gets hot and heavy. Cause now we've also already filmed the TV commercial. It's already been edited. I get to do the voiceover for that. So that's fun. I go in and do like a crazy Halloween voiceover.
That's great. You
know, get your tickets now, all that nonsense. And then, so that's fully produced. So then we head into the actual promotional phase in September where social media, we start buying advertising on social, YouTube, of course the TV and radio campaigns start to launch. And then we're in totally like, oh my God mode of buttoning up these houses because, there's so many components. I couldn't even, the bullet points list is insane.
Oh, I bet.
The lighting, the sound. Yeah. And it's very custom. You know what I mean? Cause if a designer makes a room that's supposed to be a chicken coop, then there's so many things to legitimize that. Even the soundtrack has to be the sound of chickens. So just imagine that. There's 400 houses.
Yeah.
They all have 20 something rooms in it. It's like, you know, that's why I got so overwhelmed in year one. I was like, my God, there's all these little offshoots. Like if I had a flow chart, it would just look like a tangled ball of yarn. There's just so many logistics. But so, you know, like most big projects and most big productions, the 2 weeks before opening, it's just like, I feel like we're living there. And Alex is almost living there. Like, cause since his operations, he handles getting the midway rides in there. He handles setting up.
He does that too.
Yeah. All the vending tents. Cause he does operations at the fair in general. So.
Oh, okay.
Fright Nights is kind of like a little blip on the map compared to the fair. So.
I gotcha.
So for him, he's a little bit desensitized, whereas I'm still like,
right.
Is it all going to get done? You know, and he's like, of course it is.
Yeah.
Like, of course it's going to get
done. Yeah.
Cause I'm doing it, you know, but,
That's great.
Yeah, it's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah. And so, you know, it's just an area that the artist would not think of going into, but it started with you, you know, with set designing.
Yeah.
And for some people, it starts with the makeup, you know, being makeup artist. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So.
And I skipped over that whole thing. I learned makeup because of it. I wanted to do my own makeup, so I learned it.
Yeah.
It's just like painting a painting. So it's just different materials. So now I've had the opportunity to teach special effects makeup classes because I kind of crash course myself through how to use the materials. And now I found a way in my career to monetize that. Oh, you want to learn special effects? Okay. The Armory actually had me do it for the teen summer camp this year. So, everything is an opportunity.
Oh, the kids must have loved that.
Oh, they went nuts.
Yeah.
And it was all gore. Yeah. No one wanted, I thought there'd be some girls who'd be like, I want to be a princess, or boys who wanted to be robots. Everyone wanted, as an American Horror Story. And, you know, they're just, I was like, oh, okay. Well, I'm ready for you because, you know,
yeah,
I like the horror stuff, but
that's great. Yeah. That's great. Okay. So, yeah, you know, and I've got to post a picture on the website of you in the full, your full Fright Nights makeup too. But we're going to go from that, and we're going to talk about your fine art too, because you are an excellent artist, and you are selling canvases. You're displaying in some great galleries. So tell me about the evolution of your art on a canvas, so to speak.
My fine art is still evolving, of course. So it started in the weird and twisted and all that, because that was the comfort zone coming out of coming out of art school, and
heavy metal music.
Heavy metal music, and having done album covers for local bands and stuff like that. And it was always going to be weird and twisted. And my brain is kind of weird and twisted anyway. So it was just natural. Like, when you want to get the ugly stuff out, that's what it was for me. It was a valve. And it still kind of is. It's just that what comes out now might be not necessarily ugly. It might be thought provoking, or it might be something that a social commentary piece or all that. So the evolution has moved. I've allowed myself to do things that are pretty, allowed myself to do abstracts instead of figurative. So I guess just over the years, as I came up out of my 30s and into my 40s, I believe there was less barriers as to what I thought I should do, and more like a, what should I try? And without the fear of it coming out like crap, because it might. And then you just paint over it. I finally got to that point. The same thing I tell my students is just paint. If I got white gesso right here, if you botch it, we'll freaking blank it out and you just paint over it.
Yeah.
And so I've done entire, you know, 20, 30 hour paintings that I consider to be complete garbage, and I gessoed over them. But I had to try the thing. And some of them are still around. Some of them I let live as a reminder to continue to push myself and not always just be safe and weird. But allowing that weirdness and sticking to it for so many years, and kind of honing it to not be so evil and undigestible for general folks, has actually carved me a nice little niche where people hire me for it. They're like, but the weird surreal stuff with the characters and the robots and the this and the that, that's what I want. And I'm like, thank God, I love you. You're my favorite kind of
good
client. And so those clients are starting to pop up more and more because I've just showed enough of that stuff for it to be juicy. And I know I'm veering off into commercial work, but
That's okay. An example of that is the mural that you did inside of the Brewhouse Gallery with the robots. And so did they hire you to ask you to create the Brewbot that kind of – is that kind of like their mascot? They've used it for different things?
It became – the Brewbots were drawn for another brewing company, Civil Society Brewing Company.
But, okay.
They didn't – it's not that they didn't like it, but there was a lot of partners there, and a lot of people had ideas of what they wanted on their walls. They were just opening. I ended up doing some abstract, funny enough, abstract color and stuff like that on these pillars that they have. And another artist, Mendieta, did a big logo for them. And so anyway, I had the Brewbots in my sketchbook, and this is when AJ was expanding into that second space at Brewhouse. And I showed him the drawings. He's like, I absolutely love it. So I got the parameters of the wall, and I put them into a scene together, and hence they were born, and we put them on T-shirts. And
oh, that's great.
I popped one out on the back wall there at the big back alley mural that he has going. So this is a perfect example of where my canvas art and my commercial art start to intertwine themselves. I use my abstracts that are generally just for interior design purposes and to be shown in that realm, and those things end up in the backgrounds of my pop art or things like that. So it's all just become one big soup. Sometimes it's hard to delineate. Like when I was making my website, I'm like, I had a fine art tab and I had a commercial art tab, and I'm like, I'm looking through my portfolio and I'm like, but what's what? I don't know which is which.
Right. I mean, is it the subject matter? Is it the dollar value?
You know,
how do you figure this out?
I delineated by, was it for a client or was it for me? And that's
okay.
down to. And
all right.
And for me, then it's fine. And if someone said, I want a thing, then it went, but it looks like the same. In a lot of cases, you look at them and it's like, God, this is the same stuff, man. But,
yeah.
The abstracts, they all fall into that fine art category. So the fine art ends up being a lot of that stuff, which I am just, my friends, including Trina and Rolando and Anthony, talked me into this whole abstract thing. Cause they're like, look at the background of your painting. Like, take that subject matter out of there. It's done, man. Stop putting a thing on top of this. And I was like, oh, I don't agree, you know, because I'm coming from the cartoon side of things and I'm all.
Yeah, it needs a robot on top of it.
Hard lines and I like illustrative stuff and blah, blah, blah. And so I finally just took a chance. And actually, one of the first ones got into the Art Palm Beach call. One of the first,
That's great.
That was quite invigorating. And then I sold a few at a contemporary living gallery up in, at the time it was in Gardens. And that was on the interior design. So I was like, wow, this is like a whole other little slice of pie here. And it does, it's again to say easily digestible because a lot of my other stuff won't be because of the subject matter or the feel. But this is just so up the middle because it's really just color and passion and emotion more than do you like birds? Do you like this? Do you like that? There's no subject matter. So it's for them to, I see a bird in it, but it's not a painting of a bird kind of thing. So.
Right.
I've really just embraced this abstract thing, and I just lucky enough to sell one last week. So it continues. It just continues.
Oh, that's great. And I've seen that your abstracts have evolved too.
Yes.
You're doing some different things and changing. And that's great.
So for every figurative, every couple figurative pieces I do an abstract as kind of a break, you know, for my brain.
Okay.
Cause it's really there's no technical aspect per se of me like having to find line or shade or anything like that. It's more just like, let's see what happens kind of thing. And still it's a learning process. The last one I did like 20 hours and I covered 80% of what that 20 hours was. Cause I was like, this has gone awfully wrong. I just got to cover it with big swipes of white and,
Gesso, you are my friend.
And it came around and reintroduced itself as a completely different painting. And, one of my collectors fell in love with it and purchased it. So it's a good example of like, the formula is an ever changing amoeba. So why try to explain it?
I
can't.
Right.
I can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we've talked about a lot of different things, that you teach a lot. You teach, also through the Lot 23 program where you live. I actually talked about that in one of my episodes, when I talked about art residencies a little bit, kind of alternative art studio spaces. We've talked about murals, your, illustration. What have we missed? Because, and also, I'm trying, you know, where I'm kind of talking to you in a linear way, but I want people to recognize that there's nothing linear about your career because everything is all at once.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you're going to be in the middle of Fright Nights, but if somebody says, hey, can you make this abstract for me? I'm sure you will find the time.
Unfortunately, and fortunately, simultaneously during Fright Nights, I'm doing a mural right now at a taco place up in Jupiter, Papi Chulo. And I've got a commission painting waiting after that. And I'm like, why did I book these things?
Oh my goodness.
But, no, it's not.
It looks good on paper back when you booked it in July, right?
Cause the calendar was empty. I'm like, oh, it's just Fright Nights. Just Fright Nights. Are you insane? But it's, you're saying linear. My career looks like that same ball of yarn that I described earlier of a flow chart career. Good luck. I can't figure it. It all links together. The music thing is something we didn't touch on, but
because your music is hitting it big right now. You're playing all over the place.
I think it's a right place, right time. The original music scene is coming back now. It took a break for a while, in my opinion. And there's a lot of cover bands. Not that there's anything wrong with that. But the live original music venue is back on its way. I think downtown and City Place and all that has got a shot in the arm recently. And then other beautiful enclaves like Lake Park Art District really taking foot has changed that. So my band has been blessed with getting just almost anyone I've reached out to for a gig has been like, oh, live original music? Yeah, let's bring it. You know, and that was so not the case 5 years ago. So we're just glad we're out there. We got about 2 hours worth of material. We're probably heading into the studio soon to record some kind of 3 or 5 songs just to get something down. And
what's the name of your band?
Raised by Wolves.
Raised by Wolves. Okay, I'll do a link to the social media for that as well.
I've never stopped doing music. It's just, it went from, man, I want a record deal to I just have to do it because it's in my blood, to take it all the way back to my uncles, or my great uncles, I guess. They were all big band musicians. My grandfather was a horn player and a singer in his own big band. So like, that stuff is in here. I just didn't, my voice changed and I stopped for a while. It's been a constant thing where it stops and it starts and it stops. So here we are starting again with a new band, and, I'm thrilled because it's another creative outlet. So it just keeps my head screwed on tight.
Yeah, that's great. Where can we see your art? Do you have any of your fine art on display around town right now?
I've got my two stalwarts. I've got stuff at Brewhouse, which they rotate every 3 months. They do a quarterly thing. So artists, if you're looking for walls, I'm sure, Suzanne, you might have mentioned this before. That's a great venue. And Contemporary Living, which is now also in Lake Park.
That's right. They moved. Yeah.
I've got abstracts there. I've actually got a portrait of my grandfather who plays horn there that I did of him playing horn. So I've got 5 pieces there, I think. And then I've always got, my freshest work usually ends up on the wall at Lot 23 before it goes anywhere else. Cause I'm just kind of looking at it before I put the final coat of clear on it. Like, is it really done? Which is really not a good practice. I needed to get the heck out of there and just hang it before I go back into it. I can do deeper shadows. Right.
So yeah, I have not signed it yet. So that means I could still add paint to it if I want.
Paintings are never done, right? You just stop working on it.
Yeah. 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 And I want to go back to Lot 23. So Lot 23 is the name of your art live and work studio space where you work, but then they also have their own separate space, the Lot 23 studio.
Yeah.
And through them just tell me what the agreement is about how, as a resident of Lot 23, that you also do teaching, and that's through
West Palm Beach CRA.
Okay.
A couple moons ago came up with this program. They had these two buildings, these 8 units here in Northwood Village, like just outside of the little downtown strip. And they came up with a concept of artisan residency program, for lack of a better description, because it's a little bit different than your typical.
Right.
But it would be reduced rent, and still is reduced rent. And the exchange for that is X amount of community service hours in the form of cultural teaching. And I say cultural because it goes dance, music,
ukulele, right?
I mean,
yeah.
Eric has even done
Tai Chi.
Yeah. Capoeira. It's all over the map, but a lot of visual art, teaching, drawing and painting was my niche. And now my wife Renata is teaching the drawing. So that's the trade-off. We provide free classes for the community and we get reduced rent. So the reduced rent, is just a beautiful thing because it allows me to be a little more picky about what clients I might take on, or do I need to back every single job right up to the last job I just finished? Or can I take 2 days off and just chill? So it's basically created freedom. And I've been here, this is my 4th season here. And, so it's just taken my career to the next level. So many thanks to the CRA and to the program itself. And CCE, Center for Creative Education, is a partner in that too. And all of those entities have made this happen, and therefore provided me the opportunity and the 9 other artists here the opportunity to take their career somewhere else, because you're not scrapping and clawing to keep the lights on. So
right.
Beautiful.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. And it's just a great opportunity for the kids of the community to take some classes, and it's free. It's free to their families.
And
free for anyone to take it.
And it taught me to teach. That's the other beautiful thing.
It
literally taught me to teach. And that was a scrapping and clawing kind of thing, because there was no training per se. They just interviewed us and they're like, do you have experience teaching? And the answer was yes, but it was kind of like a really weak yes, because the only teaching I had done was at Jerry's. We taught some drawing classes at Jerry's, and I learned a bit from one of my mentors there that worked alongside me. And so quite honestly, I was fake it till you make it style. I mean, I knew
that's the way you got to do it. Yeah.
I knew I could teach. It was just to what level, I knew how to do the thing. That's the teacher thing, an obvious statement, but I knew how to draw, but could I tell someone how to draw?
Right. Can you break it down into steps that are easily understandable? Yeah.
I made an outline. Yeah. Like I took it all the way back to like, you know, pre-K. I was like, yeah. And this. And I read a few basic drawing books just to, like, you just take this stuff for granted, but how are you going to tell right. someone this, man? And that's what I love about teaching. It's the ever changing. So when I started teaching painting, I had to do the same thing. I'm like, do I know color theory? Do I know it enough to explain it, or do I just have an inherent vein of it running through my
body? Intuition.
Yeah.
Right.
And it was mind blowing, and it's cool. And that's what I like about teaching. I like to see other people's eyes open up like, I just had an aha moment. Awesome. And whenever that happens for a student, I'm just gleeful because I'm like, all right,
oh, I bet.
You just stepped off a plateau. I mean, bad news is you're on another plateau and we don't know how long it is. But you're off the other plateau. That's the good news.
Right, right, right.
It's all plateaus, buddy. I'm on one right now.
That's great. All right. So I'll put links in my show notes to all these things where they can find your classes through Lot 23 or through CCE. And where can we find you? What is the name of your website?
It's craigmckinnis.com. So just my name. So it's right. it's a weird spelling, but you'll find it. I'm doing lots of SEO work to try to get myself ranked on Google. So I should be searchable if you just pop my name in there. There's some doctor out there. How dare he have my name? And he's out there doing wonderful things with medicine, but he's really muddling up my Google search with all his,
oh my gosh,
all these
yeah,
groundbreaking. Doesn't he know that art is more important than medicine? No, I'm just kidding.
How dare he? I've got a lawyer name with my same name, and she keeps getting in the way too.
Oh man.
Oh my gosh. Okay. And then you're active on some social media sites as well. Which ones?
I just do Facebook and Instagram. My Instagram is probably okay. the most fun to visit because it is a daily glimpse. Once in a while I'll do a throwback, but it's a daily glimpse into my work schedule. I'll do time lapse videos there. And I dump those to my Facebook art page, and, people who are learning art will like my Facebook art page because I sometimes will have a folder that has the process from the sketch to the canvas to the final painting. So
okay.
It's a lot of that. That's kind of – it's not instructional per se, but it is informative. So I try to keep my social media exciting.
I need to help you break into the world of online classes because you'd be great at that. It's an awesome
– I agree with you.
It's an awesome form of art income.
And I can wear pajamas.
Right, exactly.
Yeah. Appreciate you very much. I appreciate you.
Yeah, well, great. Thank you so much for doing this. You have a good day, Craig.
Do the same.
Wow, what do you think of all that? Do you think you could work at a haunted house, maybe doing set design or makeup, and work your way up to designing all the rooms and managing all the cast members and the customers and the makeup artists and everything else he does over a busy Halloween season? While you're continuing to make fine art and teaching and painting murals? I hope at the very least this will help you to expand your idea of what you can do as an artist. I hope you'll take the experience you have and try something new. Be sure and check out my show notes for this episode on my website at suzanneredmond.com. I've got links to Craig's website and many other things that we discussed. Here are some great takeaways from this episode. Number one. Find artists who are putting on art shows in your area. It's a great place to sell your work and to meet other artists. Number two, meet other artists. Whether it's from teaching or working at the local art store or joining an artist group, get out there and meet artists you can learn from and you can collaborate with. Number three, make your own opportunities by forming art groups or creating pop-up galleries. Number four, try other ways of earning income with your art. Like painting murals, doing makeup or body painting, teaching, or doing set design. Number five, look for non-traditional spaces to show your art, like Craig has at the Brewhouse Gallery. Number six, if you want to teach but don't have experience, read about techniques and work on writing down the steps you take to make your art. And number seven, work to develop your style of fine art, like Craig did when he started painting abstracts. I hope Craig has inspired you to get out and meet the artists in your community and to try new types of art. And don't be afraid to work at many things at once. You need to just take advantage of opportunities when they come.
As always, I post a lot of photos of the artist's artwork and business in my show notes for the episode. So be sure and check out the photo of Craig in full Halloween makeup as his alter ego, Eggman. Imagine meeting that coming around the corner at Fright Nights. If you're enjoying these podcasts, be sure to go on iTunes and leave me a review. And thank you for listening to The Left Brain Artist. I'm Suzanne Redman. See you next time.